Our next case is 11-1740, James A. Lang et al. Versus the Director of the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services. Mr. Hendershot.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The question in this case arises in what is often called the scheme of cooperative federalism. That is, a system of 100% federally funded benefits distributed through a state system. Here, not only is the wage subsidy 100% federally funded, but the federal government pays the state's cost for administering the system. The specific question here is whether the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services, as an agent of the federal government, commits error when it distributes these benefits exactly as directed by the Federal Department of Labor. The answer here is no, because the Department of Labor...
Counsel, doesn't it really come down to how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? If I understand the facts correctly, these three people would have qualified, except they took a job too soon within the 26-week period. They turned 50 before the 26 weeks ran. Is that right?
That is right, that their 50th birthday came before the 26
weeks. And you're telling us there is no latitude for the state to say close enough.
Your Honor, the state does not have latitude here. It is, like I say, an agent of the federal government. It is compelled by contract, which is the first document in our supplement, to follow the Department of Labor's instructions.
Is there specific language in the contract?
That says
on this specific fact pattern, you're 50 before the 26 weeks runs after you lose the job that would qualify you for these benefits. But you took the new job before you were 50. Therefore, you're out. Is there exact language that rejects them from qualifying in the contract?
There is not that exact language in the contract. That exact
language
comes
down to interpretation by the state.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. The contract, I think it is just two steps. The contract, if you look at page 3 of our supplement, obligates the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services to follow Department of Labor directives. That's step one. Step two is the directive that I don't think anybody here contests is ambiguous at all. That is this TEGL document 2-03 that's cited throughout both briefs. That unambiguously says in Part E that an applicant must be 50 years old at the time of reemployment to qualify, among other things, to qualify for these benefits. So, as I was saying, Your Honors, the state doesn't have discretion to deal with that. They're an agent of the Department of Labor. They're bound to follow Department of Labor directives.
Has anybody from the state raised the question of this fact pattern with the Federal Department of Labor to see, are we right or wrong here? In saying, you know, this seems inequitable. Help us out here. Would we be okay to provide the benefit? Has that kind of inquiry taken place?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that is in the record, but the ODJFS is in contact with the Department of Labor constantly on these issues, and in this case, I believe the Department of Labor did tell ODJFS to appeal. If you'll recall the record, the first hearing in the Lang case, which came first of these three, at the commission level hearing, there was a determination to award benefits. The Department of Labor there did recommend to JFS to appeal that to the full commission level. That happened in the Lang case first, and that then the Labey and Sharp cases came after that, following the full commission hearing as precedential. So to the Department of Labor directions, Your Honor, I think those where they directed ODJFS to distribute these benefits according to the directions, that is the most natural reading of the controlling federal statute that can be found at 19 U.S.C. 2318, and that is for several reasons. The first is It makes the most sense of the two uses of the age 50 requirement in that statute. The age 50 requirement shows up first as part of the group certification process. As part of that process, which is the first prerequisite for individual benefits, and that is a federal process the Department of Labor conducts. The first question the Department of Labor asks there is, are a significant number of workers in this group age 50 years old or older? If at the time of that petition, these three claimants, they were all 49 or younger, if less than a significant number had been 50 at that point, we wouldn't be here at all. The process would have stopped right there, and no member of that group would have been eligible for benefits. So the Department of Labor's interpretation of this statute, placing the age 50 requirement at the moment of reemployment, makes sense of the two uses of the age 50 requirement in this statute.
But does the statute specifically say that the applicant must be the minimum age of 50?
The language of the statute, Your Honor, and this is at 2318A3B, lists the six requirements for an individual to qualify for benefits.
And,
says,
one of those is that the applicant must be the age of 50, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. The third requirement reads, is at least 50 years old,
right,
in the list of six.
And at the time of the application, all of them were.
Yes, Your Honor. At the time of application, as I read the record, each of these three applicants was 50 at the time of application.
And the program from the department is to provide the supplement between a lower wage employed person and what they would have had. That's the purpose of the supplement. Am I right?
Well, the supplement does operate, as you indicate, Your Honor, as a supplement of 50% of the difference between the old wage and the new wage.
Yes.
But the purpose of the statute is the congressional concern was job loss and relatively quick reemployment by those who are 50, not, I would suggest, as claimants are reading the statute, by those who will eventually become 50.
So the Common Pleas Court made the determination that because they were 50 at the time that they filed the application, they qualify under the statute. But there's a conflict then between the letter agreement, the Department of Labor and the administrator in Ohio, that the age of 50 has to be at the time of their reemployment. But the time of reemployment isn't in the statute, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Well, the time of reemployment is not in the language. It's not directly tied to the is age 50 requirement. Reemployment is implicit in many of the other six requirements. You measure, for example, does the applicant, are they making $50,000 a year or less? That's measured at the time of reemployment. Have you become reemployed within 26 weeks?
Maybe I'm not making the question clear enough. As I understood it, the agreement letter between the Department of Labor and the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services said that the applicants must be 50 at the time of reemployment.
That's correct, Your Honor. The contract, as well as the interpretation,
doesn't appear in the statute, and the Common Pleas Court here followed the statute, which says 50 at the time of application.
Well, I wouldn't say it is the Common Pleas Court simply followed the statute. The Common Pleas Court, if you look at page 5 of the Common Pleas Court's opinion, recognizes that the statute is ambiguous. What the Common Pleas Court then did was interpret the statute, but I would say without the appropriate deference to the Department of Labor's interpretation. And I think looking for an explicit language in the statute that says when does the age 50 requirement exist is exactly backwards of the way this court has approached administrative deference questions. If you look at, for example, Northwestern Ohio Building and Trades Council versus Conrad, there this court reversed the 10th District, which had held that there must be explicit textual support for an administrative agency's interpretation.
Are we equipped to resolve the conflict between a letter of guidance and a federal statute?
Well, I don't think there's a conflict, Your Honor. What there is,
is there ambiguity?
Absolutely, there's ambiguity.
Well,
even
are we
the
equipped
Common Pleas
to deal with that?
I'm sorry?
Are we equipped as a court to deal with that ambiguity, or is this a problem for the Department of Labor?
You are equipped to deal with that, and one of the tools
to tell them to modify their agreement? They're not even a party here.
No, I don't think that is possible. You're absolutely right. You're equipped to deal with how should the court approach the ambiguity if you find there to be ambiguity in the statute. And that is something the court deals with all the time. And both
but
with
I think Justice Pfeiffer was getting at the problem that seems to exist between the administrator in Ohio and the Department of Labor in Washington. And we don't resolve that conflict in this court, do we?
Yeah, I don't think there's a conflict. What happens is the Department of Labor's interpretation fills in an open question in the statute. But I think,
Your
Honor,
does the congressional act, the statute, supersede the guidance letter?
No, I think the act here leaves several open questions, as many statutes both of the General Assembly here in Ohio and as the federal Congress do.
We can interpret this, the federal congressional enactment, as we would an Ohio statute, the way that we see that it reads.
I think that's primarily correct, but I think there's one additional layer here, and that's something that several sister states have pointed to. In these schemes of cooperative federalism, one principle of deference that may not be in existence if you were just looking at an Ohio administrative agency are concerns of national uniformity and respect for the federal government. Some of the cases we mentioned in our brief that point to that, for example, the Perales decision from New York's highest court, and the Orr's decision from Pennsylvania, which specifically looks at the same document that's before you here.
And the federal government.
If we find a conflict between the letter agreement and the statute, we can apply the statute, can we not?
Again, Your Honor, I'd resist one of the premises there, which is that there's a conflict between the letter and the statute. The statute.
If we find a conflict, we can apply the statute. Or if we find ambiguity, we could apply the statute.
If you find ambiguity, I think this court's own administrative deference jurisprudence, as well as the contract, as well as this lesson from sister states like the Orr's Court in Pennsylvania, all would point to deferring to the Department of Labor's interpretation.
Thank you. I think another member of the court has a question.
And the Department of Labor, the federal department, said, peel this because we don't agree.
That's right. After
So they're telling you right there they don't agree with the interpretation. They've made their decision that 50 means 50, and they're telling you to appeal it and look because we have a state court that has ruled legally, so we much have to appeal it.
Well, the appeal I was talking about was from the first administrative hearing at the UCRC. That is where the Department of Labor there said to JFS to appeal it to the full commission level. And that at that point, the full commission did rule in favor of JFS, and then the claimants appealed that to the Common Pleas Court. But you're right, Justice Stratton. The Department of Labor did suggest to JFS that they appeal that initial administrative determination.
So, Mr. Hendershot, when we have ambiguity, it basically means there are two reasonable ways of looking at something. And here we don't know when the age 50 was supposed to be, but the Department of Labor has made a statement that it's at the date of reemployment. If we defer to the department, then we accept their interpretation as long as it's reasonable. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. And as this court said in Serb versus Miami University, you defer to administrative construction of a statute unless it's barred by the explicit text of the statute or unreasonable. Here, I think deference is absolutely appropriate. If you look at what Judge Clelby said in the Common Pleas Court, he said at page 5 of his order, this is an ambiguous statute. If you look at the Third District's panel opinion, you have Judge Rogers saying, this is not an ambiguous statute. It can mean only what the Department of Labor says it means. And of course, Judges Shaw and Wilimowski disagreed with that and said it can mean only what claimants said it means.
Counsel, how widespread is this problem?
Your Honor, this is the first case we're aware of that has raised this problem in a reported decision. Certainly, there are at least three gentlemen in Ohio here that face this very
problem. We know if there's
problem.
More than three gentlemen or citizens of Ohio that are in this predicament.
I'm not aware of others, but certainly the question that's before this court is much broader than just this ATAA program. It's much broader than just the Trade Act program. This is an instance where a state court, and as far as I know, it's the first appellate decision in the country that has ordered a state agency to breach its contract with the federal government to take action and pay out benefits directly contrary to the directions of the Department of Labor.
But isn't that the issue, is whether, in fact, it is an actual contract? Because I believe the appellees argue in their brief that Congress has amended this statute and did not, despite two other state Supreme Courts having an issue on this very specific age 50 thing, did not modify the statute to make it clearer. And whether or not the financial agreement between the Department of Labor and the Governor's Office of the State of Ohio is, in fact, a contract, isn't that what appellees' argument is?
Your Honor, I don't take their argument to be that there's not a contract, and I also don't think they're pointing to any other state appellate decision, Supreme Court or otherwise, that has dealt with this narrow issue. So in terms of the age 50
Haven't there been two state Supreme Courts that have interpreted this language the way that you're arguing? I thought I saw that in your brief.
There are other courts that have addressed this document, the Teagle 2-03. It covers a host of questions. It covers all kinds of questions that Congress left open. Only one of those, say 100 questions or more, is this age 50 requirement that's before you.
How important is the retroactivity of benefits to your argument?
It is certainly one part of the Department of Labor's overall interpretation of the statute. It's one of the questions that Congress left open, and I think it certainly dovetails with what the Department of Labor did with the age 50 requirement. It is really an act of grace that allows those who apply for this to apply not as soon as they get on the job, but have some time to apply thereafter. So my time is counting up. I'll reserve any time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kowalski.
Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm representing three Ohio workers who were put out of work when their plant moved to Mexico. They got other employment. They had been advised by the Seneca County Department of Job and Family Services that they would be eligible to participate in a program that Congress had set up to assist workers such as they, who were older workers, to encourage them to seek reemployment as quickly as possible. The program provides for a supplemental benefit equal to half of the difference between their old wage and their new wage, and they would be Congress wrote the statute so that if the group was certified, which it was in this case, the group of workers apply for certification, or the union applies, or even the employer applies to indicate that this group of workers is being affected in this way by a trade problem, and therefore they should be eligible for the program.
Okay, counsel, I have some questions about your interpretation.
Yes.
There's a 19 U.S.C. 2318B, skip all the other numbers, has six provisions, correct?
Correct.
And they're all written in the is state, correct?
Correct.
They don't say will be, may become, or anything else. They say is, correct?
Correct.
And your position is that it's not the is when they got employed, it's the is that applies to when they actually asked for the benefits under the statute.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay,
the statute.
So let me ask you further.
Yes.
Then. You're saying that is 50 years of age only applies when they apply, not when they got the job, correct?
Correct.
So if they're earning only $48,000, or no, we have to earn more than that. Let's say they're earning $55,000 when they got the job. Then they drop to 50. Can they apply 2 years later?
They can apply later, Your Honor. And
if they're not employed on a full-time basis when they're 48, and 2 years later they're employed on a full-time basis, then you say they can apply.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So you're saying that none of these things apply for when they get the job. Rules 1 through 6 do not apply when they get the job, as long as when they actually make the application, they then qualify. That's your position.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So your is does not apply under your interpretation to getting the job. It only applies to when you make an application.
Correct, Your Honor.
And there's no deference, in your opinion, to the Department of Labor, the U.S. Department of Labor's interpretation that is applies to the time they make the application.
That's correct, Your Honor. We believe the statute is unambiguous. It says that a worker may elect...
It's quite ambiguous. It wouldn't be here if it weren't ambiguous. And well, I can easily read it saying when they get the job, is means is when you get the job. And there's clearly an ambiguity or you wouldn't be here. And so why don't we defer to the U.S. Department of Labor, who created this program's interpretation? Why do we interpret an ambiguity the way we would like it to read? What right do we have to do that?
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree that the statute is ambiguous. It says a worker may elect if, and then there are six requirements. If the worker meets each and every one of those requirements at the time the worker applies, the worker can get the benefits.
Where does it say at the time the worker applies? Where is that language?
It's implicit in the wording, Your Honor.
Okay, it's as implicit as being actually 50 when you get the job. Just as implicit as that?
Well, Your Honor, the Department of Labor's interpretation combined two of these requirements into one and therefore changed the requirements. If the worker is covered by the certification, all these workers were. If the worker obtains reemployment within 26 weeks, all these workers did. If the worker is at least 50 years of age, all these workers were when they applied. If the worker earns more than $50,000, now.
Okay. Obtains employment not more than 26 weeks. Okay, let's say they got employment at 26 weeks, but they apply, and now it's 28 weeks.
If they apply two weeks later?
Or two years later. They're now past the 26 weeks, but if you say the status at the time they apply is what matters, then two doesn't fit, because two says 26 weeks, and now they're further down the road.
Well, Your Honor, at the time they apply, the ODJFS will look at their application and determine for which part of that period were they actually eligible. Did they actually meet all the requirements?
If they applied, if they got work at 26 weeks, but they apply now at 30 weeks, you're saying now we're looking at when they got employed, not when they applied.
Well, they would be collecting benefits for those 4 weeks, and during those 4 weeks, if they were eligible and met all requirements, they would get
So some do apply and some don't apply at the time they got the job.
That's correct, Your Honor. The provision is to allow the workers to apply at any time. Many workers will not know about this program.
When you say at any time, following up on Justice Stratton's scenario, they're 48 years of age, and they are unemployed, then they become employed within the 26-week period.
Correct.
Okay? And then you would agree at that point they're not eligible.
Correct.
Okay. But they turn 50 2 years later, year and a half later. Can they then, under your scenario, apply?
They can apply, and they would be eligible only during the period in which they met all the requirements. So during the period in which they were 50, they could get the benefits.
For how long? They turn 50 January 1st.
Well, the two-year period only lasts from 2 years from the time they obtain reemployment. Now, during that 2 years...
But that 2 years has expired, and they turned 50 with, 18 months into that two-year period. They're only allowed for the differential or the compensation for 6 months. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. In this scenario that we have before us...
Yes.
Their 2 years start running from their date of employment...
Date of reemployment, yes.
Date of reemployment, okay. So they're pretty much, because they turn 50 several weeks later, they're...
I think a couple months.
They're only entitled to the balance, less than, or maybe a year and a half, year and 18 months, something like that.
Correct, Your Honor. This gets to the point that was made regarding the time at which all of these requirements must... kick in. The argument has been made that it has to be at the time of reemployment. Well, actually, that's not the case, because the department looks at the applications of workers throughout that period to ascertain whether or not they are employed, whether they are employed full-time, whether or not they are earning more than $50,000 a year. And that is something that the workers have to provide evidence of throughout the period.
So the question is the window of opportunity that they have to apply for this. If everything else is correct, they turn they're reemployed within the 26 weeks. They turn 50, but they don't find out about this benefit until they're 53. They're out of luck.
That's correct. If they find out about the benefit within that two-year period and apply, then the department would look at their qualifications during that period and give them benefits for the period during which they were they met the requirements. So, for instance, if a worker applies, let's say, a year down the road, and during that year a worker has been worked part-time only because maybe of a cutback at the plant, was reduced to part-time work for a couple of those months. Well, for those months, the worker would not be qualified, and for those months, the worker would not get the benefits. For the rest of the period during which the worker was employed full-time and presumably did not earn $50,000 and met all the other requirements, then the worker would get the benefits for that period of time.
Counsel, do we have really two questions here, don't we? One is whether the training guidance letter comports with the federal statute. That's one question, and apparently that has worked its way into the cases here. And the second question is, even if it doesn't comport with the federal question or federal statute, is Department of Job and Family Services required to follow it regardless? And the training letter is pretty clear, isn't it? Because it does say, if I read this correctly, at the time of reemployment. So that one is clear, but is the state required to follow that even if the Department of Labor incorrectly interpreted the federal statute under the contract that the state has?
The state is required to follow the statute, Your Honor, and Justice O'Donnell correctly stated that there does seem to be a conflict. There is a conflict between the statute and the TEGL, the Department of Labor's interpretation of the statute. There is no basis for the department's interpretation. There's no explanation anywhere in the TEGL or anywhere else.
There's nothing in the agreement between the federal government and the state of Ohio that the state is required to follow the department's the federal department's interpretation?
The contract does indicate that the state is supposed to follow the department's interpretation. But, of course, the state, the statute itself requires the states to review decisions regarding the program as it would other unemployment.
So you would claim that that is an invalid part of the contract between the federal government and the state may just disregard it. Is that essentially what you're arguing?
Because the policy, the guideline put forth by the Department of Labor, does not follow the statute. It conflicts with the statute.
You raise an interesting question when you made the term policy. One would look at this and you think, well, what policy would indicate that you couldn't, if you, at the time of reemployment, you weren't 50, you couldn't collect it. But if, you know, a week later you turned 50 and applied, you could. Have you been able to determine what sort of policy would be behind this pretty restrictive rule?
We've wondered ourselves, Your Honor. There really is no justification for that requirement. In fact, it runs counter to the policy that governs the statute, which is to encourage workers to seek reemployment as quickly as possible.
Would all workers who were laid off from the age of 48 at some point then be eligible when they reached 50?
Well, it depends on if they, if during that first 2 years after they get reemployment, they turn 50, they would be eligible.
So all workers from the age of, even though the statute says you apply at 50, any worker who is 48 ultimately could qualify.
For a period of time during
you're
which
you're 47 and you turn 50, you would not, because there's a 2 year period.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Mr. Kowalski, that's where my concern is, where you say this doesn't have any rationality. It seems to me if we're talking about helping people who are 50 and over, that very situation applies if you're saying that you're 48, you potentially have 2 years to apply, and then you get retroactivity. Let's say you get employed at age 48, you don't apply until you're 50, then really what you'd be doing is allowing retroactivity of benefits from the date of reemployment up to the date of application, and you're talking about potentially allowing 48 and 49-year-olds to benefit when the statute says 50 and over.
Well, no, Your Honor, because if when you're for the period of time in which you are only 48 or 49, you are not qualified and would not get the benefit. Only for the period of time during which you're 50 and worked full-time and met all the other requirements would you get the benefit.
That's the position your clients are taking, is that correct? But is that in the statute that way?
Well, the statute reads the worker may elect to receive the benefit if, and then it lists the six qualifications. If you meet the benefits, then you get if you meet the requirements, you get the benefits.
You're not claiming any retroactivity. You're claiming that if they're 50 and got 1 month left, they only get 1 month of benefit.
Correct, Your Honor. They only get benefits during which they meet all these requirements. Again, if the worker is not employed full-time during some portion of that period, the worker does not get the benefits during that period of part-time employment.
Counsel, what's the grand sum of money this is going to cost the federal government for each of your clients?
Well, the maximum benefit is only $10,000 per recipient, per applicant, Your Honor. So we're not talking about a lot of money. I would also state that, as we made clear in our brief, the repercussions decision upholding the Court of Appeals would not be grave. The department, Ohio's not going to lose these benefits. The statute requires that if the Department of Labor does not have an agreement with a state, if, for instance, the Department of Labor decided to cancel this agreement, the department would then have to run the program in Ohio. I don't think that's going to happen, Your Honor.
But who would pay for it?
All this money comes from the federal government.
Right. Even if for some reason we would side with you and then the federal government decides to cancel this arrangement with the state of Ohio, then the federal government starts running the program directly?
That would be the requirement of the federal government. Again, I doubt that's liable to happen. And Ohio workers for whom Congress designed this program would be shut out if the Court of Appeals decision is not upheld in this case.
And same question. What's the extent of this problem?
Your Honor, we do not know. We have these three gentlemen who have applied. I don't know of other cases. I think it's interesting that all three of them were advised by the Seneca Department of Job and Family Services that they were eligible. And, in fact, in three of the four decisions from the Unemployment Compensation Review Commission, the hearing officer pointed to the statute and said the statute does not require them to be 50 at the time of reemployment. Only because of the contract with the Department of Labor, which the Department of Labor reminded the UCRC about after the first decision in favor of Mr. Lang, did the state decide that it had to have rehearings rehearing of Mr. Lang's case and then rule the same way on the other cases.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I see my time is up. I urge the court to uphold the well-reasoned decision of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you. Mr. Hendershot, you've used all your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Quick points. One, to the repercussions. The repercussions here are not just the $30,000 that are potentially in effect. They are, as I mentioned before, making this the first appellate decision in the country compelling a state agency to breach its contract with the federal government, compelling a state agency to pay out these benefits directly contrary to the Department of Labor's instructions. And this is not the only scheme.
And then what would happen?
Well, then, as my friend here mentioned, the federal government would take over, likely would take over the program administering it in Ohio. And that would have short.
How would they administer it in Ohio any differently than what we would have decided with regards to this case? They would be bound by what we say, correct?
Well, I'm not sure that they would be bound by this court's interpretation of the federal statute. I think they would probably follow, they perhaps would follow their own guidelines. But I think the repercussions would be this for workers. As the federal system replaced the state, inevitably some of the 28,000 workers that are on the rolls of this program would likely slip through the cracks. And another problem is going forward with the federal government administering this program and the state government administering other programs for those facing the terror of job loss, now you have the worker faced with going to two different places to coordinate their own benefits instead
of one. So they'd get all mixed up, just like they did when they followed the advice of the person at the local unemployment office.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that issue has percolated its way up here. As I read the Lang transcript, the April 3, 2009 transcript, page 9, the attorneys there disclaimed any estoppel argument based on what was said in the Seneca County office. I do think, Justice Stratton, your line of questioning shows that the Department of Labor was faced with drawing certain lines. Drawing a line as they did does disadvantage those who have this birthday problem like the three gentlemen here, but it advantages different groups of claimants who will be disadvantaged by these claimants' interpretation, those that you pointed out, Justice Stratton, those who are making under $50,000 at the time of reemployment but more at the time of application, those who are employed full-time at the time of reemployment but part-time at the time of application. Taking claimants at the time of application interpretation would disadvantage those groups, but of course advantage them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision.